From the studios of KPCW in Park City, this is Cool Science Radio. Science and technology that is accessible and entertaining, and if we can understand it, so will you. I'm Katie Mullally.
And I'm Lynn Ware-Peak. And this morning, Katie, along with our colleague John Wells, speak with renowned theoretical physicist and best-selling author Michio Kaku, who joins us once again to talk about his new book, Quantum Supremacy, How the Quantum Computer Revolution Will Change Everything.
Then John Webster of the U.S. Biochar Initiative talks about how the simplest, most accessible, and even oldest solutions can be the most effective. Case in point, biochar. This carbon-rich material made from simple biomass has been around for centuries, and its uses go way beyond just enhancing our soil.
These guests, when we return, you're listening to Cool Science Radio. Stay with us.
Welcome back to Cool Science Radio. I'm John Wells. I'm here with Katie Mullally. Our next guest is Michio Kaku, who is a professor of physics at the City University of New York and the co-founder of string field theory. We last spoke with him in April 2021 about his book, The God Equation, which became a national bestseller. Kaku rejoins us this morning to talk about his new book, Quantum Supremacy, How the Quantum Computer Revolution Will Change Everything. The runaway success of the microchip processor may be reaching its end, but humanity's next great technological achievement, quantum computing, well, it's coming our way, and it may unlock our deepest mysteries of science and solve some of humanity's biggest problems like global warming, world hunger, and incurable disease. Michio Kaku, welcome back to Cool Science Radio.
Glad to be on the show.
We're delighted to have you back. And let's start with this. Your book's organized into four parts with four or five subchapters in each part. Tell us how your book is organized and presented.
Well, I start chronologically. Computers have gone through three basic stages. The first stage was analog computers, where we use levers, gears, pulleys, switches to do a calculation. You turn the crank and you do a calculation on an analog computer. Then World War II comes along, and there was a national priority to use electricity to create eventually transistors to make the second generation of computers, the microchip. We're in the second stage now, but now we're nearing the end of the second stage. Moore's law, which says the computer power doubles every 18 months, is slowing down. We see that now, because microchips are so small that transistors are going to be maybe 50 atoms across. At that point, they short circuit. So we have to go to the third stage. The third stage is quantum computers, the ultimate computer. You can't get smaller than an atom. And we're going to be computing on atoms with quantum computers. And this is not science fiction. They already exist. In fact, that's what's called quantum supremacy. Quantum supremacy is a time when a quantum computer can beat an ordinary supercomputer by a factor of millions of times on certain select tasks. Now, of course, these quantum computers cannot be used for general tasks, but for specific tasks, they leave digital computers in the dust.
And Michio, before we get into the quantum area, I very much appreciate your respect and your reverence for what came before. And in your book, you talk about Bardeen, Brattain, Shockley, who brought us the transistor in 1956, made the trip to Stockholm to pick up their Nobel. And since that day, Moore's law has never missed a step. Can you just take a minute and talk about the significance of the transistor and how it scaled?
Yes, a transistor is basically a gate. Think of a gate that governs the flow of electricity, and then a valve. A tiny valve will control a large amount of water in a pipe. Now replace the pipe with electricity and replace the valve with a transistor. You now understand how transistors work. A transistor is a little valve that allows you to control the flow of a large amount of electricity. But you know, transistors are so tiny now that you can pack a billion of them on something the size of your fingernail, which means that each transistor is about maybe 20, 30, 50 atoms across. At that point, if you get any smaller, the quantum principle takes over. You don't know where the electron is anymore, and it leaks out. That's why, here's the question. Would you buy a new computer for Christmas knowing that it's just as powerful as last year's model. We're talking about a collapse of the industry. Silicon Valley could become a rust belt. There could be mass unemployment in Silicon Valley because no one wants to buy a new computer. That's where quantum computers come in, because they compute on individual atoms. Now, an atom can be either, let's say, positive or negative, or let's say zero and one. It's called binary, okay? So an atom in a magnetic field can either be up or down, zero or one. But now a quantum computer comes in. A quantum computer says, no. Think of the atom in all possible orientations. How much more power do you have if you calculate this way? Well, obviously you have an infinitely more number of states to calculate with. So a quantum computer is infinitely more powerful than a digital computer. We can solve problems that would take forever on a digital computer and solve them like that on a quantum computer. This is amazing, absolutely amazing.
So in your book, I love how you talk about all these different potential areas, or, you know, probably probable areas for quantum computers and the solving of the problems, such as global warming, cancer curing. So what will that data input look like into a quantum computer as opposed to what we input now into our typical computers?
Well, in a typical computer inputs zeros and ones, digital information. But that's only a tiny fraction of what's actually available. Think of Mother Nature. When you walk outside, you see photosynthesis happening. And then you say to yourself, wow, does Mother Nature use zeros and ones? No, Mother Nature is way past zeros and ones. It's way past digital. Mother Nature talks the language of the atom. And the language of the atom is different from zeros and ones. The language of the atom is in waves of electrons. And therefore, we want to create a computer that speaks the language of Mother Nature. For example, photosynthesis. Mother Nature takes light, photons, combines it with carbon dioxide to create oxygen and, chlorophyll. And as a consequence, that drives the world. The world is driven by photosynthesis. That is a quantum process. Now try to duplicate that with a digital computer. You can't.
Right.
So the processes, for example, taking nitrogen out of the air to create fertilizer, okay? Vegetables do that. Vegetables can take nitrogen out of the air and create a fertilizer. But we cannot do that with an ordinary digital computer. You need a quantum computer to do something like that. So to create a second green revolution, to feed the world, we may have to use quantum computers. And that's just the beginning.
So what, I'm such a visual person, and you work in theoreticals. What will it look like to receive the data from a quantum computer? Will it look like a spreadsheet of numbers and theories and equations?
Well, it's not going to be a series of numbers, because that's the language of digital, okay? Zeros and ones. First of all, how will we communicate with a quantum computer? You're not going to have a quantum computer in your living room, because they're probably going to be very big, okay? Because you have to cool it down to near absolute zero. Probably it's going to be hooked up to your wristwatch or maybe your contact lens. So your contact lens will be connected to the web, which is in the cloud. So the quantum computer is not going to be in your laptop. The quantum computer is going to be in the cloud. It'll communicate with you through your wristwatch or your contact lens. You will blink and you will have access to the entire storehouse of human knowledge. And so that's the kind of information that we're going to be storing with a quantum computer. And again, we don't insert tape into a quantum computer, because that's what we do with a digital computer, okay? But there are different ways of doing it, different ways of using electromagnetic radiation to communicate with atoms, because that's the language of nature. The language of nature is the language of atoms.
If you're just joining us on Cool Science Radio, we are speaking with Michio Kaku, who has written The God Equation. We spoke to him back in April 2021. Please go ahead to Cool Science Radio and grab that podcast. It's a fascinating conversation. And this morning, we're speaking to him about his new book, Quantum Supremacy, How the Quantum Computer Revolution Will Change Everything. And Michio, classical computers have error correction, and that's pretty important. And for just one application, a trading floor application, where hundreds of millions of dollars can be lost or found, per second, it's important to have accuracy. And because we can't get to absolute zero, what sort of challenges does that present for the quantum computer?
Well, if you were to look at the weak spot of quantum computers, it would be in that very same question of error correction. You see, if somebody sneezes in the background, if somebody jumps up and down or talks too loud, the vibrations normally we would simply dismiss. But these vibrations at the atomic level could disturb the calculation and ruin the calculation. Therefore, you have to cool everything down to minimize noise, to minimize disruptions. You have to cool it down to near absolute zero. And that's costly. That's why quantum computers are so big. If I showed you a picture of a quantum computer, it looks like a chandelier. But you see, the chandelier is not the computer. The chandelier is the cooling system, a very elaborate set of pipes. They give you near absolute zero. The actual quantum computer is about this big. We're talking about something this big is the actual size of the quantum computer. So that's the weak spot. Now, Mother Nature has solved that problem. When you go outside, you're looking at quantum computers in the flowers, the trees, the leaves. Photosynthesis is a quantum process. Mother Nature has quantum computers at room temperature. We're not there yet. Mother Nature is still one step ahead of us.
Yeah, they certainly are. It's just fascinating. You mentioned something in the book which really caught my attention, and that was after Google made its claim of achieving quantum supremacy, the Chinese announced they broke a barrier of calculating in 200 seconds what would take a digital computer a half a billion years, 500 million years. I know that there's a lot of excitement and those sorts of things, but it sounds very sensational. But is that possibly true?
Yes. First of all, it's a horse race. And first out of the gate are, one, the Chinese, and two, IBM and the Americans. Now, what the Chinese have done is, instead of using electricity, which is slow when we compare it to the speed of light, they use light. They use photons to do a calculation. And they use beam splitters to split the beam. And then you have a whole bunch of arrays of mirrors and things like that to do a calculation. And they can do a calculation, as you said, millions of times faster than a regular computer. So it's a horse race. First out of the gate is IBM and the Chinese, but very close behind is Google and Microsoft and Honeywell and all the other companies. So it's a horse race, and there's billions of dollars being put on the table now. We're talking about big bucks. Some of the biggest bucks in Silicon Valley are lining up to see which version of the quantum computer will win the race. And who is watching this race? The CIA. Because they know that whoever wins this race can break into any other digital computer and steal the crown jewels. That is, all the top secrets of nations are guarded by codes, but a quantum computer in principle is so powerful, you can break the codes. So who's interested in setting guidelines for quantum computers? The US government. This is big bucks. There's a lot riding on this.
One of the many things I loved about your book was it really brought the idea of quantum computing to the everyday person and how it can affect our lives, because you read about it, well, not you read about it, you look at it and you go, that's not, I'm never going to understand that. But how you portray this in the book, it's like, look, this is going to affect all of us. And with all of the areas that you talk about, again, climate change, cancer curing, was there an area that got you really excited about?
Well, one thing that is right out of the headlines of medical journals is the question of Alzheimer's disease. You know, that could be the disease of the century. My mother died of Alzheimer's disease, and it was heartbreaking talking to her, knowing that she didn't recognize me. She didn't even know that she had a son. Mm-hmm. That's the devastation caused by Alzheimer's disease. And now we know, we solved the riddle. How is it possible that some people have gummed up brains with lots of gums in their brains, and yet they're perfectly normal? Now we realize that there are at least two types of amyloid proteins that gum up the brain, two types. One type actually will eventually kill you, and the other one is actually rather harmless. It turns out that at the molecular level, one Alzheimer's molecule spins to the left, but the other one spins to the right. These are molecules that spin in different orientations. One of them kills you, the other one doesn't. And if we can then use quantum computers to separate these two, we may have a handle. We just might have a handle on how to cure the disease of the century. Because when you start to hit your 80s, about 50% of the people have Alzheimer's disease when you're in your 80s. And so this could be a possible cure for the disease of the century.
So as scientists are working on the quantum computer, are they working directly with these other scientists and experts in these fields, such as Alzheimer's, to ensure that what they develop will be useful?
They consult. In different areas, these people who do quantum computers are consulting with people in industry, in the sciences. For example, I'm a physicist, and our biggest atom smasher is in Geneva. It's called the Large Hadron Collider. It's about as big as the city of Geneva itself. It's so huge. And now we use quantum computers. We're actually using quantum computers to analyze the data by smashing atoms apart. And that may give us an inkling of the secret of creation itself. Why was there a Big Bang? Why did the universe set off the way it did? Why do we live in this universe? We may answer that question with a quantum computer that is already now being used to process the data from the Large Hadron Collider outside Geneva, Switzerland. So there's a lot riding on this, on the promise of quantum computers.
Michio, I'm curious about this. There were so many interesting things in your book, but the thing that really grabbed my attention was a quote that you gave of Richard Feynman. Nature isn't classical, damn it. If you want to make a simulation of nature, you better make it quantum mechanical. That was the quote. And when I heard that, when you start thinking about the world through the natural environment, through nature as being a quantum machine, it kind of changes the way you look at the world. And it kind of gives you an appreciation of what these quantum computers might be able to do, maybe not at room temperature, but it's just fascinating.
Right. And if you want to see what a quantum computer can do, simply go outside to a garden. When you look at a garden, you look at the flowers and the leaves and everything like that. What's happening? These are quantum processes. Light combined with carbon dioxide, giving you oxygen and chlorophyll. This reaction drives the world. And Mother Nature solved that problem billions of years ago. This is old hat for Mother Nature. So we're simply retracing the steps that took place billions of years ago. Our machines today are still clumsy, I'll have to admit that. But one day they'll be perhaps right up there with Mother Nature. Mother Nature is in some sense a quantum computer. All the wonders that we see around us are quantum mechanical. And nature does not use the language of zeros and ones. That's a human language. We humans devise the language of digital. That's what we call the digital revolution. The right. Next revolution is going to be the quantum revolution, where we don't use zeros and ones anymore. And so global warming, energy, fusion power, all these things can be recast in the language of quantum computers.
There are a lot of questions that everybody has of all the different approaches for quantum computing. What one question do you have that has not been answered yet that you'd like to have answered?
Well, I would like to know, how is it possible that Mother Nature could do everything at room temperature? We, clumsy as we are, we have to cool everything down to near absolute zero so that there's no vibrations. And what Mother Nature does is that Mother Nature takes a snapshot, a very, very quick snapshot before all the air is built up. And that's why they can do quantum calculations at room temperature. That's what we really need. Who wants to have a gigantic chandelier in your living room doing a calculation? It's going to be put in the cloud. And it's not going to be something that you can put in your living room. But like I said before, in the future, we'll communicate with that in the cloud. And that's how the average person will be able to communicate with a quantum computer. For example, we can now analyze your blood to pick up 50 different kinds of cancer. A blood test. Think about this for a moment. We didn't have that before. But this year, it's now legal to get a blood test to analyze 50 different kinds of cancers. I think in the future, maybe your toilet will be hooked up to a quantum computer analyzing instantly your blood from billions of people on the earth to search for cancer. In other words, the word tumor may disappear from the English language. Quantum computers may cure the cancer epidemic in the world by analyzing people's blood without even your knowing it, analyzing it in the cloud, and then telling you that you have cancer or telling you that you should start to change your diet and things because you could be having cancer. So the cure for cancer could be quantum computers.
Well, in your book, you talk about how AI and quantum computing are working together. They're learning, they're problem solving, they're bringing in new variables. How are they separate from one another? Because I think most of us just assume that they're all the same thing.
Well, think of the controversy about chatbots, for example. A chatbot is basically software that combines different essays on the web and cobbles together your essay. So this is a product of basically software, not hardware. Quantum computers is hardware. We're talking about the real guts of a computer program. And so with hardware, we can now compensate for the deficiencies of software. What's the problem with chatbots? The problem is they can lie. They can deceive. Okay, teenagers can write all sorts of nonsense, which are then incorporated into your essay. And so all sorts of nonsense jumps out. Fact-checking is too difficult for software. Cannot be done. Therefore, fact-checking is simply not there. However, that's where hardware comes in now. Quantum computers is hardware. Hardware is powerful enough to do a fact-checking. And that's how we can remove all the idiocy, remove all the nonsense that creeps into the internet. Because the internet, all it does, it cobbles together existing essays that are already written by some human, i.e. a teenager wanting to create havoc on the internet. And so that's why they work together. AI that we talk about in the newspaper is basically software. Quantum computers is hardware, and we need the hardware to do fact-checking of the software.
So we've got the quantum computers getting ready to answer all of these scientific questions and hard, basically scientific questions. But also, will it be able to answer philosophical questions? Because some of that isn't based in fact.
Quantum computers basically use what is available, which is quantum mechanics, the quantum mechanics of atoms. Okay, once you talk philosophy, you're talking at the very edge of what is known about the quantum principle. You see, the quantum principle works in multiple universes. We don't tell high school kids this when they learn chemistry, and they learn a little bit of quantum chemistry. We don't tell them this because it kind of freaks them out. But quantum mechanics exists in parallel universes. That's why it's so powerful. How come a quantum computer can outrace a digital computer? Because a quantum computer operates in many universes at the same time. Now, this sounds like something from Marvel Comics or something from science fiction. But where did science fiction get this? Science fiction got the idea of a multiverse from quantum physics. In quantum physics, we have the famous cat problem, that a cat in a box can be dead and alive simultaneously. Now, if a cat can be dead and alive simultaneously, it means you can compute simultaneously in different universes. And that's the power of quantum computers. So this is philosophy. So you're absolutely right. Ultimately, you bump up against the question, why? Why are quantum computers so powerful? Because they compute in different universes at the same time.
Michio, I spent a lot of time out at Bell Labs in Homedale and also in Murray Hill. And I used to love going into the lobby a little earlier so that I could look at their Hall of Fame. I mean, 26,000 patents, the laser, the transistor, charged couple device, photovoltaic cell, Unix, the C operating programming language, and of course, Robert Wilson and Arno Penzias, who found and discovered the microwave background. It's just fascinating that we had this organization that did basic research. I want to talk about something I've been thinking about, and that's that our U.S. kids in the United States have been dead last in math and reasoning skills. And since the pandemic, it's gotten even worse. Where will the next Edison, the next Bardeen, Brittain, Shockley, where will these people come from?
Well, you're right about the American educational system. On average, the average high school kid scores near bottom on almost every single international science test monitored by the UN and other international organizations, dead last. However, there is one saving grace, and that is the so-called genius, the guy who is a little bit of a crazy person like Steve Jobs as a kid, but is, you know, has a brilliant, imaginative, creative mind. These people are nurtured in our society. And so that's a saving grace, that we do produce the Steve Jobs. We do produce these people that are at the cutting edge because they have an imagination that cannot be stopped, okay? We have to nurture that. But like I said, in the future for the job market, we have to make sure that the average person has a slot waiting for them when they graduate from high school. So we have to make sure that not just the geniuses, but the average person can fit into this process. Because of course, things are not getting less technical, they're getting more technical. And think of a blacksmith. We don't have blacksmiths anymore, but we don't cry about that because of course, blacksmiths became automobile workers. But now we have a computer revolution and we have to make sure that there are jobs waiting for people that are monitoring, servicing, making possible the computer revolution.
Michio Kaku has just written Quantum Supremacy, How the Quantum Computer Revolution Will Change Everything. Michio, we want to thank you for joining us again on Cool Science Radio, and we wish you continued success with the program.
Okay, thank you very much. Glad to be on your show.
Welcome back to Cool Science Radio. I'm Katie Mullally.
And I'm Lynn Ware Peake.
Sometimes the simplest, most accessible, and even oldest solutions can be the most effective. Case in point, biochar. This carbon-rich material made from simple biomass has been around for centuries, and its uses go way beyond just enhancing our soil. Here to talk about biochar and the science and technology behind this simple, ancient, and abundant material is John Webster, Director of Communications for the U.S. Biochar Initiative. John, welcome to Cool Science Radio.
Oh, good morning.
Thanks for having me. Oh, you're welcome. Thanks for joining us. So first question that I know most people have on their minds, what is biochar?
What's a biochar? Yeah, a couple ways to think about biochar. You already described it pretty well, but effectively what we're doing in the industry is we're taking biomass, so any organic material, we expose it to high heat through a number of different processes in an oxygen-restricted environment. And what that does is it all the insides of the material, especially the non-carbon bits, they all exit in gases and other materials. And commonly what we're doing is we're capturing those, but then you're left behind with this really beautiful form of charcoal. If you want to think about something similar to a sponge or a coral, where you've got this solidified material and then you have all the porosity in there, that's a lot of what the inside of biochar looks like. What are the advantages of this kind of fancy charcoal? Well, effectively what it can do is it can really hold on to a lot of water. And in the Southwest region where we are, I'm based out of Salt Lake, so I'm close by to you. We're the second driest state in the nation. Biochar holds a tremendous amount of water. And what's nice about it is it adsorbs it, meaning it sits next to it, but it doesn't absorb it, meaning it doesn't go into the material to be held permanently. So what this means is it comes as your inputs like water come in and it'll hold on to the water for a period of time and then slowly release it. So you get a much higher value out of that input. So it allows you to save save some money on your water bill, and then also to use less of it. And we need to honor those sacred resources here. It's also a fantastic way to deal with waste biomass, like woody biomass, hazardous fuels. In addition to holding the water, it also hangs on the nutrients. So what does it mean when you have something like a biochar installed in your soil? You've got a nice damp or at least increased moisture environment. There's a physical and chemical process or property to biochar, and the microbiology, they just absolutely love it, and they survive and thrive and multiply. So now what we have is we have this nice damp environment. We have thriving biology, their outputs, those are what feed the plant roots. So they're what are building more of the organic matter in our soils. So this is something, what we're talking about is when we add this into the environment, especially for agricultural purposes, turf, garden, shrub, tree, that we can have more with less. We can have more with less. Now, one of the questions that I get is that, well, is biochar like a fertilizer? Well, biochar does have, depending on what it's made from, so the type of material makes a difference on what comes out. The duration for which you convert it also can make a difference on the nutritional value.
Biochar is an ancient remediation tool, isn't it? What can you tell us about how it's been used over the past decades and centuries?
The Japanese have been using agricultural charcoal for over 2,000 years, so that's new. That's no new process for them. It's just that it got a name back in like 2009. So that's kind of what's different about it. Biochar is one of the most well-studied materials in science, in terms of the fact that it's been around for a while. There's over 30,000 technical peer-reviewed papers and technical articles on the material. It has been around forever. And that's kind of one of the things. It's like that suddenly the new kid on the block that you've never heard of that's been around forever. We used to have and honor a fire cycle, largely because we didn't have the mechanisms in place in order to control things like forest fires and prairie fires, or they were happening when it was just in nature. Well, those processes would stabilize the carbon, because what happens is when you are burning without oxygen, which can often happen in a forest fire or wildfire, brush fire, it'll burn from the top down. Here's a quick example of what pyrolysis is. You know, when you strike a wooden match and it looks like the flame is sitting there up above the wood, that's because it is. It's not actually combusting the wood. It's combusting the gases that come off of the wood. And that heat that is generated by where the oxygen is spark meet those off gases, that heat is driving into the wood and causing more of the gases to escape. And then what's left behind is that stable carbon structure that we were talking about earlier that kind of looks like a sponge or a piece of coral, but it's all stabilized and it's black, beautiful carbon. But now what we're doing it is we've realized what the value was of the carbon cycle, the fact that this removes carbon from the atmosphere, because Mother Nature has already got that down pat, right? I'm sure there are ways that mankind can figure out to improve that process, but for now, Mother Nature's the best at it. So what we're doing is that instead of letting that biomass sit out anywhere from like 3 to 50 years, it might all of it go back up into the atmosphere. We are stabilizing the carbon through these different types of processes. Hopefully what we're doing is we're putting it in soil, or we're putting it into materials like the built environment. These days they're looking at putting it in things like insulation and drywall, plastic siding for these combination materials, and then of course agricultural purposes. Now when we're making these, we're doing these in low emission type ways. And that's kind of the important message here, because you know, when a wildfire or forest fire burns out of control, we get all that smoke up into the atmosphere. When we do it in these types of mechanisms, either at the low-tech, mid-tech, or even the high-tech plants with these massive commercial pyrolyzers and gasifiers, we're doing so in a new kind of a way, oftentimes a computer-controlled kind of way when it's at scale, or in a way where we're understanding how to manage fire for good and create this charcoal material.
If you're just joining us on Cool Science Radio, we're speaking with John Webster. He's talking to us about biochar, what it is and what it does and how it can help our soil protect water quality. And let me ask you this, John, how would would we know if we were looking at a, do you call it an incinerator or a biochar facility? How would we know if we're looking at one?
Well, often they're contained in buildings or shipping containers. Sometimes they are out and about. You know, it all depends on the scale of the facility. Sometimes they can almost look like those oil refineries down in Salt Lake off the side of the road by the point around the Capitol Hill area. They can even end up looking a little bit like that. Typically, the emission stack is controlled, so you don't really see much of anything. You might see some wavy lines here and there, but by and large, it's not really easy to tell that you're looking at a pyrolyzer. And again, it's typically what you're doing is you're heating the biomass, so it's not absolutely not incineration. We're stabilizing anywhere from 50 to 60% of the carbon that's in the original source material is getting stabilized. Oftentimes, depending on the process fuels itself for many of these systems. So it's relatively low inputs, kind of runs on its own power many times, and then comes out with that beneficial material called biochar.
And I'm just wondering, as you've been talking, John, it's made me think about how at our house, we had to stop composting because we were attracting pack rats and it became a problem. And so it makes me wonder, is there some sort of home biochar pyrolyzer that you can do? Can you do it at home?
It's interesting because biochar can be both low tech and high tech, right? Because you were asking about the history of biochar. And if you're familiar with the Amazonian soils and the Terra Preta, the black rich soils, it's estimated that a lot of those are the result of man's fire management practices, meaning that what they were doing is they were cooking in pits, which is an oxygen restricted environment. They'd put all their waste and low value materials into those pits, cover it up. Those embers would continue to heat everything in the absence of oxygen. They'd go back later and dig up all this charcoal and spread it around. And that's why they have these little islands. There's some real interesting documentaries about it and some historical studies like in the book Burn. So that's kind of where one of the ways that we came upon biochar again. And then there were also indigenous practices, but you can literally make biochar in your backyard. I've done it in a fire pit. You can even, if you want to geek out with it, you can even do it in like little soup cans. I mean, you can make it at any number of scales. So but yeah, you can make biochar at home. This is science for all. I think the other thing I want to point out is that when you start adopting biochar into your agricultural practices, home, garden, farm, you're not getting on the drip. You don't add biochar every day, every year. You don't have a necessary schedule. Effectively, once you install it in your soils, it's generational soil health. So if you have a handful of newly made biochar, the science is beginning to show us that 75% of that handful of biochar will still be there in the soils doing its job after 1,000 years.
Wow. So yeah, in addition to the soils, you were talking about earlier, biochar goes beyond just soil remediation. You briefly touched on insulation and some other uses, but let's go back into that. I find that fascinating. How else can we utilize biochar?
Well, I think the important question, and that's a good question, the important thing to ask is where can we use carbon? Mm-hmm. This material, depending on how it's made, this material commonly from a commercial system is going to be anywhere between 85 and 95% pure carbon. So carbon is very simple. It's around us everywhere. It's very simple, but it's very elegant in the solutions that it offers us, especially with today's problems. Odor control is another way that it's utilized. So if you have animal operations, you were talking about your home composting, attracting pests. Often, if you don't have the smell of rotting materials, you don't get as many pests, especially the flies. So it's commonly used in barns and chicken and poultry operations. Some cattle folks will use it in their composting. That's a real interesting thing, by the way, is that last year, the University of Merced in California did a study. And what they were doing is they were adding biochar at 20% by volume to dairy manure. And what they found is that there was an 84% reduction in methane off-gassing from that manure was co-composted. And then it also had a much higher nutritional content. You know, when we're talking about practical ways to reduce greenhouse gas emissions, so when we're making it, we're reducing the amount of greenhouse gas emissions associated with CO2, methane, and nitrous oxide. We're reducing those. Now, when we add the product to something like you know, an everyday issue that we have, because we have a lot of, we have dairies. If we add it to that manure, we can reduce that methane significantly. It's measurable for animal health, human health, environmental health. It makes a killer compost.
Well, and I was reading that they were talking about using the biochar process for a lot of the forest clearing, not forest clearing, but when they actually thin forest, the dead trees, mm-hmm. any other sort of, you know, when you have the typical big piles of trees and lawn, and instead of just letting them rot, which can actually add methane into the atmosphere, or just the traditional slash and burn, it can actually, in addition to capturing the carbon, and it can actually turn it into biochar. How would they do that in places that are remote, say the Uintas, if they wanted to turn all those extra dead trees into a biochar product?
You know, it all comes down to cost. So it all depends. And that's kind of the famous answer with biochar. It depends. First off, I want to say that there's no such thing as the perfect biochar. There's only the perfect biochar for the application. We have such a diversity of feedstocks we can make it in. We have such a diversity of processes by which it can be generated. We can do things like changing the residence time and the temperatures. Effectively, you were asking about biochar as a material for incorporation into the built environment. We can control the end result. Sometimes we can add things to it before, and then before it goes through the heat process in order to capture more things. There's a mix. If you add, there's an iron that if you add it to it, to your raw feedstock, and you put it through, it binds together. And the studies are showing that that attracts and retains more phosphorus after that's been made. But yeah, it's the way we can deal with it in the places like the Uintas. They're already doing typical hazardous fuels gathering now. They're putting them into burn piles. Sometimes they get contracts where people will take them off and they'll do post and pole operations, like for your pole fences or some other lumber operation, but there's always extra. So there's something that needs to be dealt with. The Forest Service is spending a lot of time and money trying to figure out the most effective way to do this. One of those mechanisms that they're developing is something called the CharBoss. It's a machine. You can think of it as an air curtain burner. It pushes the air and the gases back through into the heat source. It has very, very low emissions, and you can tow it behind a truck and get it up. So it does require access to roads, but you can get it up there. It's a way to process a lot of biomass fairly quickly. And that has about a 5%, maybe 7% conversion ratio to biochar. So at least something's being left behind instead of having those big burn piles that scar the Forest Service.
Oh, just wanted to ask you, go back for a moment to dairies and to ranching operations and the methane coming out of manure there with the addition of biochar. I mean, how are ranchers being incentivized, or are they using biochar currently? And if not, why not?
Biochar as a material has been inconsistent as a supply in the market. So biochar has been inconsistent in the market for a while. The methodologies required to make it at the high-tech level typically meant that we were seeing costs in the $300 and up range per cubic yard for the material. The good news is that we get more producers coming online. There's about 200 producers in the United States. As we get more producers online, we're seeing that the cost of the material is dropping. We're also seeing that there are these bioenergy companies that were already processing wood materials into energy. They have found a way by which they reduce the total amount of power that they capture, but instead of outputting all this ash that they were commonly sending to landfills, they're generating biochar. And so if you're near a bioenergy plant that does this type of conversion, you can commonly find biochar down in the $75 a yard. That gets more affordable. You know, a big tote of nitrogen is very expensive these days, and it typically is something that lasts you for one season, maybe not even an entire season, where biochar has all of the material. Biochar has that long-lasting permanence and durability that we spoke of. Yeah, so in terms of the value, you know, biochar is an investment. It's not a cost. Again, I say biochar is an investment, not a cost, because this material that you're putting into your soils, 75% of it will still be there in 1,000 years.
Wow.
So, and again, it all depends on the biochar, as long as it's made under certain standards. But that's not too hard to achieve. But and then that one other process, because I know that one of the questions is about how do we deal with the biomass that's higher up on the hill that's a lot more difficult. That ring of fire system is a 16-panel system that you bolt together, and we have pictures of it on our website and on the Wilson Biochar website, but at the biochar-us.org, we have links to like our Biochar in the Woods program, and as well on our YouTube channel, we have information that shows how those work. But what you can do, those will, one of those firebox kiln technologies will literally fit in the back of a Subaru.
So, I don't think I'll be hauling my Subaru around with a biochar set.
Yeah, so, but the burly folks that are going up to the top of their hall, they can carry that. And it only takes about 100 to 150 gallons to quench.
Wow.
No, so you can get both the material and the water in. You can safely burn.
Biochar, I mean, it's easy to talk about all the benefits of biochar. What are some of the drawbacks? I know I was reading about they're not sure if it can affect the pH of the soil. And then I also have a friend who's a farmer who's trying to make it himself, and he's worried about, he wanted to know about the carbon output. You addressed that a little bit earlier, but there's got to be a couple of drawbacks to biochar.
Well, along with anything, if you don't know what you're doing, it can be difficult to do it within parameters that are responsible. So there are some folks that'll put up a big pile, they'll light it on fire and call it biochar.
That's a bonfire.
Yeah, yeah. So that's, you know, that's like the thing with the ricks that are being built with the when we do our burn piles. Top lit updraft. We were talking about pyrolysis before. Top lit updraft. So when you light a fire from the bottom, there's a lot of smoke that comes out that generates a lot of pollution. There's a fair amount of PPM that goes up, as well as your gases like your methane and nitrous oxide and CO2. When you burn from the top, again, what that's doing in that pyrolysis process, and referring to the matchstick analogy, when the heat is up on the top and the heat is pressing down, and then as those gases come up, they're going through a bed of flame, then that is one way that we can stabilize the carbon. We can reduce the amount of greenhouse gases that are going into the atmosphere. So again, but the material, so you burn it all to, you burn it all down to ash, like 90% plus of all of that is absolutely going, like a lot of it is all going back up into the air with no material left behind on that low-tech process. You do it in a little bit more sustainable way. Read up some information that can be found on the biochar-us.org website. And you can make a reasonable material. I mean, you can literally dig a pit and make it in a pit. But that, you know, that's a good question. The downsides are, you know, anything that's responsibly made by somebody that takes the time to learn about it, there's commonly very few downsides. You know, fire safety is always very important. Mm-hmm. So I'd like to point that out if you're doing it in that type of a process. From an industrial standpoint, you know, I think the thing is, like, depending on if carbon accounting is your thing, just the distance it might have to travel is not necessarily good.
Yeah.
But with the fact that we have more and more providers coming online every day, now the distance that the biochar has to travel isn't as far.
That's great. Well, John Webster, Director of Communications for U.S. Biochar Initiative, thank you for joining us. This is such an interesting topic and something that I know a lot of us, if the snow ever clears, a lot of people will be wanting to incorporate this into their soil. John, where can people go to learn more about biochar and the U.S. Biochar Initiative?
That's our website. That'd be the best, at biochar-us.org. We do have a directory on there where you can find local providers. Some of the box stores are now starting to carry biochar. Often a lot of your custom boutiques will be CSAs that have sales, and they'll often find a biochar provider to participate with them. But yeah, you know, look online. It's always, you know, looking local, you might look at things like KSL or the Park Record and places like that for ads from biochar sources. See if you have something local. And if not, then, you know, there are providers that can help you with scale. One of the services that the U.S. Biochar Initiative provides is that if you can't figure it out, we can help you. You can email info@biochar-us.org. And that goes to me. My email is john@biochar-us.org. Feel free to drop me a line. I'll help you out best I can. And then You know, I think the only other thing that I'd do is that as you learn about this and you take your biochar journey and realize what the savings that we can have in the natural environment and the good that it can do, talk to your municipalities and get them to start using it. I do want to point out that Park City is very progressive. I do know personally, I've worked with them for a number of years now, and there are some trials that are going on. We did install some biochar up at Miners Park at the top of Park City. Under that turf, it was right before they cut the water back 40% citywide a couple of years ago. That biochar performed beautifully. It held up, it's held up to the traffic. You know, there's a tremendous amount of foot traffic and whatnot. So an example like that really showcases the benefit the biochar can bring. And so, yeah, so encourage your municipalities to use it in your yard. You can be a carbon farmer. You can be a carbon farmer, sequester that carbon in your turf and be responsible about it. We're all in this together. So any of you scientists and activists out there that want to come on and help us evangelize for soil and chemical and carbon to use in the built environment, we're always looking for help. We are a volunteer-based organization. Again, feel free to reach out to me and we'd appreciate the help.
Well, John, thank you so much. Again, U.S. Biochar Initiative. Thanks again, John, for joining us.
Thank you so much. It was real fun.
Thank you for tuning in to Cool Science Radio here on KPCW Park City. Join us next week when we talk with the executive director of the Alan Alda Center for Communicating Science about the importance of science literacy in our lives. Then we talk with Powder Watts about the new heat tape technology for your home. Apparently, it's never too early to start thinking about winter. Find our past shows and interviews on kpcw.org under the Shows tab.